Lecture 31. Final Battles. Sparta's Triumph Over Athens.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. In this concluding lecture on the fighting in the Peloponnesian War, we will first survey its last years to the Athenians' final defeat at the Battle of Aegospotami in 405. Then we'll consider the peace terms that Sparta imposed on Athens, which included a pro-Spartan oligarchy. And then finally, as something of an epilogue, we'll discuss the restoration of democracy in 403 BC. Since we're going to be looking at Athens in a fair amount of detail after the mid-4th century, it makes sense for me to bring in the restoration of democracy at the end of this lecture, since Athens would return to a radical democracy. Incidentally, Thucydides ends his account of the Peloponnesian War with the end of the oligarchy of 411. So we can actually say farewell to Thucydides here. We've got no idea whether Thucydides meant to finish his history here, or whether he intended to write a full account of events down to 404 and never got around to doing so. But for events after 411, we have to use Xenophon's Hellenica. And this picks up where Thucydides leaves off, and it covers Greek history down to 362. In fact, it literally picks up where Thucydides leaves off, because the opening of Xenophon's Hellenica has after this. So it's a continuum. Well, Athens may have regained its naval ascendancy in the Aegean, but Sparta too had made gains in this period. And we mustn't forget Sparta's alliance with Persia, and hence the spectre of Persian involvement in Greek affairs again. Tissaphernes, the previous satrap of Sardis, who had intrigued with Alcibiades despite the alliance with Sparta, had been replaced by the great king of Persia's son, Cyrus. And Cyrus was very keen to prove himself by getting involved in the Peloponnesian War on the side of Sparta. Moreover, this is the period when the Spartans make Lysander their admiral. Like Gylippus in the Sicilian expedition, Lysander was one of the Mothaces. But unlike Gylippus, Lysander seems to have endeared himself especially to the Spartan king Agis. Lysander seems to have had an affair with Agis's brother, or perhaps his half-brother, and presumably that relationship helped him get to know the king Agis somewhat better. In 407, Alcibiades finally thought it was safe to return to Athens. Remember how he turned the tables so neatly on the Spartans at sea. Virtually the whole of the city of Athens turned out to meet him when he arrived, though it was an uncomfortable return, and actually when he disembarked, he made sure he was surrounded by a couple of bodyguards. For the past few years or so, Alcibiades had been re-elected strategos. He'd performed magnificently for the Athenians. And now he was given full powers for the conduct of the war. Unfortunately, he wouldn't be around for very long, as we'll see. In 406, the Spartan admiral Lysander defeated an Athenian fleet at the Battle of Notium, in the process sinking 22 vessels. Now, this shock was so great for the Athenians that even though Alcibiades wasn't present at the Battle of Notium, he was held responsible for the defeat. Alcibiades fled again, this time to a fortified area he'd built in the Hellespont region, and he never returned to Athens. The assembly's change of heart towards Alcibiades reflects once again that his enemies were not prepared to leave him be. At the same time, it also reflects the ease by which orators continued to manipulate the people. Now, Alcibiades deserves some blame for this defeat. he had left a man called Antiochus, his pilot, in charge of the Athenian fleet at Notium, rather than staying with it himself. Now, although Alcibiades had told Antiochus he was not to do battle with Lysander, evidently Antiochus ignored him. So on the one hand, Alcibiades shouldn't be condemned for the defeat because he wasn't even there. But on the other hand, he shouldn't have left Antiochus in charge, especially as Antiochus probably lacked experience of command anyway. He was just a pilot. Even so, to remove the one person who had any chance of success in winning the war for the Athenians was still stupidity on their part. They obviously hadn't learned anything from the Sicilian disaster. Remember I said then, I had a gut feeling that if Alcibiades had been left alone, he could have pulled off victory in Sicily. The Spartans followed up their victory at Notium by besieging Mytilene. In Athens, there was panic, and the people resolved to melt down the gold and silver statues on the Acropolis for bullion, with which to buy and then equip a new fleet. They also promised the metics, as these are the resident aliens who lived and worked in Athens, they promised metics citizenship, and they also promised freedom to the slaves if they would row in this fleet. Within a month or so, Athens and its allies had a fleet of 150 ships together, and these sailed off under the command of Conon to relieve Mytilene. Now, Conon and a force went on to Mytilene, while the remainder of the Athenian fleet engaged the Peloponnesian fleet south of Lesbos, a place called Arginusae. In a major naval battle, Athens was victorious, and in that battle, the Athenians sank 75 Peloponnesian vessels. Now, among those killed in the Battle of Arginusae was the Spartan admiral Callicratidas. He had succeeded Lysander, because in Sparta, the office of admiral, or navarch, was an annual one. And this was a big difference between military commands in Sparta and in Athens. In Athens, as we know, re-election was possible any number of times, and that allowed a continuation of policy. Now, Arginusae was a battle that the Athenians had to win. They just had to win it in order to have any edge over the Spartans in this war. And it's no stretch of the imagination to say that the Athenians must have been euphoric over this victory. But then the tide turned. Conon was still fighting against all odds at Mytilene, but there were a number of Athenian crews in the water at Arginusae who needed rescuing. As their ship sank, they jumped into the water, so the expectation was that the other vessels in the fleet would turn back to get them, to save them. However, it seems the Athenians were split, the Athenian commanders, that is, at Arginusae, were split between rescuing these drowning crews and going to the aid of Conon. This dilly-dallying among the Athenian commanders cost precious time, and a sudden storm blew up, and this storm prevented the men in the water being rescued. And as a result, they drowned. Now, this was, of course, a terrible thing to happen. But when the weather got too bad, the generals at Arginusae made the decision not to help the drowning men because of the potential danger to the ships that tried to rescue them. So this was a needs of the many over the few decision. The belief was that if a majority of Athenian vessels sailed back into the straits to rescue the drowning men, then the storm would wreck these vessels as well and cost the Athenians even more. Now, in Athens, the people who, as I said, must have recognized the importance of this naval victory, must have been euphoric at the news. All of a sudden, the people found the general's action at Arginusae unacceptable, and recriminations followed. Everyone blamed everyone else. The eight generals, remember there are 10 generals or strategoi elected every year, eight of them were serving in the fleet at Arginusae. These eight generals present at that battle were ordered back to Athens to be put on trial before the assembly for negligence. And when this happened, they were found guilty and executed. The property was confiscated by the state. Well, in actual fact, only six of the generals made it back, because the other two saw the writing on the wall and prudently stayed where they were. Probably the best decision they'd ever made. Now, to us, the Athenian Assembly's trial of these Arginusae generals was a ridiculous course of action. I mean, it was these men who had masterminded the victory at Arginusae. But the verdict against them was dictated by the hysterical mood of the people. At the same time, we can sort of understand the Athenians' reasoning, because the sailors who drowned were not recovered, rather the corpses were not recovered. So religion comes into it again now, because the Greeks believed that if a person was not buried, then his or her soul would roam around in Hades forever. And so the general's orders not to go back to try to rescue these drowning crews took on a religious element as well. Now, after Arginusae, the Spartans sued for peace. Although the Spartans were not proposing anything radically different from the last time they wanted peace, they did promise to vacate Decyleia. Remember, this was the Spartan enclave on Attic soil. Now, that would mean that this enemy outpost in Attica would no longer be there. This was the time in Athens to accept the Spartans' plea for peace, because the Athenians had no financial reserves left. They had nothing else to melt down to turn into coin. And they'd only managed to cobble together this fleet that sailed to Arginusae by the skin of their teeth. The Spartan move now then was a godsend, all the more so given that the Athenians had just executed six of their 10 strategoi. However, the demagogue who was running the assembly at this time, for want of a better phrase, and this is Cleophon, persuaded the people one more time to reject the Spartan appeal. So the Athenians turned the Spartans down. Now, like last time, Cleophon was after the total defeat of the Spartans, because only by a total defeat could the Athenians then impose terms on them. The last thing they wanted was a sort of return to a status quo situation where eventually the Spartans might go to war against Athens again. Cleophon was all out for terms. But his decision now to block the Spartan peace proposals was a major blunder. He'd been right to reject Sparta before, as we talked about at the time. But the situation in 406 now was very different. His advice in 406 allowed Sparta to rebuild its fleet, and with Persian aid sent to it by Cyrus. And then Lysander was given command of the Spartan fleet. Since both sides, that's Athens and Sparta, couldn't keep on fighting, the war was evidently going to be decided soon and by one last battle. This would be the Battle of Aegospotami, and I call it the battle that never was. The Spartans had switched the theatre of war from the mainland to the Hellespont by now. And this was good strategy on their part, because the Spartans knew this was a critical area for the Athenians on the corn route from the Black Sea. they knew that the Athenians would have to respond to any hostile interference in this vitally important region for them. And that's why, in the summer of 405, Lysander of Sparta, at the head of a fleet of some 200 vessels, attacked the city of Lampsacus in the Hellespont. He attacked it by land and by sea, and he successfully seized Lampsacus. Now, that gave Sparta a significant presence on the shores of the Propontis, the modern Sea of Marmara. The Athenians immediately sent a fleet of about 180 ships and about 36,000 men or so to counter Sparta's moves in this area. They had no choice. The fleet had no single commander. It was in the hands of six strategoi. So this sharing of command was similar to the fleet that had sailed to Arginusae in 406. The Athenian fleet took up a position about 10 miles or so into the Hellespont at a place called Aegospotami. And Aegospotami is about 2 or 3 miles or so across the straits from Lampsacus. Apparently, Alcibiades, who by now is living in voluntary exile, well, there wasn't much voluntary nature to it, was there? But he was living in his fortress in the Hellespont. Apparently, he made a quick trip to the Athenian fleet here to tell the commanders to move it elsewhere. As Alcibiades rightly saw, Aegospotami was not the best place to station a fleet of this size. For one thing, there was no harbour there, only a beach. That meant that the heavy triremes would have to be pulled onto the beach when they weren't in use and then pushed back into the water in order to be launched. In the meantime, the crews scrambling to get on them. This would take time. A fleet riding an anchor could be deployed far more quickly, of course. The other thing that Alcibiades saw was that there was no adequate supplies in the area of Aegospotami to feed the Athenian forces. The Athenians had a base further down the Hellespont at Sestos on the left bank, which from the provisions point of view would have been the place to station a fleet. Perhaps the reason why Conon, one of these Athenian generals, stayed at Aegospotami was because of the need to stop Lysander sailing through the Propontis and into the Black Sea area, where he would completely disrupt the corn that Athens needed. For 4 days, the Athenians sailed out into the straits, trying to lure the Spartans to battle. But Lysander refused to move. Lysander's strategy was twofold. First, to make the Athenians wonder what he was up to. And second, it was to make the Athenians sloppy. And it did the trick. On day one, the Athenian fleet rowed out, but nothing happened, so it rowed back to shore. The same thing happened on day two. The same thing happened on day three. By now, the Athenians are probably blowing raspberries and shouting insults at the Spartans, but Lysander refused to move. And again, on day four, the Athenians did the same thing. Lysander refused to move. By now, of course, the Athenians were thinking that Lysander might even be intimidated by the size of their fleet, that he might be staying in Lampsacus hoping the Athenians would sail off and go home and leave him alone. And so the Athenians did get sloppy. They went out to look for provisions, for example, without setting up proper guards over their camp. And even sometimes they didn't beach the triremes properly. And that's why day five would be different. As I mentioned, the Athenian fleet was commanded by six strategoi. One was in command every day, like a commander-in-chief. On the fifth day, the strategos in charge was a chap called Philocles, and he devised a plan to coax Lysander out. He was finally sick of this sort of sailing out and the Spartans doing nothing. So Philocles took 30 ships and he made for Sestos. the idea being that Lysander would think that the Athenian armada was finally leaving, and so he would go after Philocles' little fleet and see if he could capture that. While Lysander was doing this, the plan was for the rest of the Athenians to bear down on Lysander's fleet from behind. He wouldn't see them, and so they would take him by surprise. Now, this plan was actually a good one, but it depended on two things. First, it depended on Lysander being fooled in this way, and second, it depended on the Athenians getting their acts together in time. In other words, launching their vessels quickly and getting on board quickly before Lysander knew what was going on. Unfortunately, hoaxes like this didn't work on somebody like Lysander. He was good. He'd been waiting for the Athenians to make a move for a week, and he knew straight away what Philocles' vessels were trying to do. When Philocles sailed down the straits, Lysander immediately gave orders for his fleet to sail. And it moved so quickly that it got around Philocles' ships and attacked them from the front. This was the reverse of what Philocles had expected to happen. That meant Philocles had no option now but to turn around and return to the Athenians with the Spartans behind him. And the Athenians back in the main camp had been far too sluggish in getting to their ships and getting them into the water. The result was all they could do was watch in horror as Philocles tore back towards them, but with Lysander and the fleet behind Philocles, and so bearing down on the entire Athenian fleet that hadn't got its act together and was actually in the water. Now, the Athenians managed to get to some of their ships, but to no avail ultimately. The majority of the Athenians present in camp panicked and ran away as fast as they could towards Sestos. In the meantime, Lysander landed easily at Aegospotami and secured both it and the Athenian fleet. About 10 Athenian ships managed to escape. The remaining 160 were captured, as were about 2,000 or 3,000 Athenians who hadn't fled in time, and they were put to death. Conon, by the way, managed to escape and flee to Cyprus, and we're going to be meeting him again fairly soon. So you can see now why I call Aegospotami the battle that never was, because there was no fighting. Lysander was victorious without having to throw a single punch. In one blow, then, the sea power of Athens was annihilated. There was nothing to fall back on, as I said before, no more statues to melt down, no rich allies. And so the Athenians had lost the Peloponnesian War. Their empire would soon be no more. The worst aspects of imperialism were realized. Lysander didn't intend to attack Athens, but starve it into surrender. His control of Lampsacus and now Aegospotami meant that he could block the corn that the Athenians needed from this area, and he proceeded to do that. This entailed him installing garrisons in Byzantium and Chalcedon on either side of the Bosporus, and ordering that if anyone were caught trying to smuggle corn to Athens, that person was to be executed. Satisfied with these arrangements in the Hellespont region, Lysander then sailed to Athens to blockade the Piraeus. That meant that no supplies could get in and nobody could get out. In the meantime, the Spartan king Aegis, who was at Decelea, marched on Athens, which was preparing for a siege. At the same time as Aegis marched from Decelea, the other Spartan king, Pausanias, invaded Attica and joined his fellow king in besieging Athens. It's unusual, by the way, to find both kings of Sparta out and about in this manner, and evidently the intention was to starve the Athenians into surrender as soon as possible and so impose terms. Eventually, by the way, when the siege grew protracted over the winter, Pausanias and his troops went back to Sparta. Now, as more and more Athenians died from famine, it was only a matter of time before the city capitulated. And it did, and the war formally came to an end in April of 404. In Sparta, an assembly of the Peloponnesian allies was held to decide the Athenians' punishment. Now, some allies, such as Thebes and Corinth, demanded the total destruction of Athens, the killing of all male citizens, the enslaving of women and children. But the Spartans took a different view, and the Spartans were able to persuade their allies to spare Athens and its people. And as justification, they said that because of the role that Athens had played in defeating Xerxes and the Persians in the wars of 480 to 479, that the Athenians should not be destroyed in this way. Now, this reason, of course, was just a pretext. The Spartans didn't give a hoot about the Athenians, but they were concerned that if Athens were wiped off the face of Greece, then another power like Thebes, which by now had come to control something of a Boeotian league, would take advantage of that situation to try to assert its influence in central Greek politics. Eventually, the Spartans saw that this would cause a problem for them, so they probably felt it was better to keep Athens intact as a useful barrier against a place like Thebes. Nevertheless, harsh terms were imposed on the Athenians. They had to destroy their long walls and the Piraeus fortifications. They were also told to dismantle the Delian League. They were allowed to keep only 12 ships, and they became allies of Sparta, acknowledging Sparta's hegemony over them. So the Athenian Empire, this Delian League, came to an end, whether it was a tyranny, as Cleon described it, or not. And that's why, as Xenophon tells us, the long walls were demolished while flutes played, because people thought this was the first day of the start of freedom for all Greeks. If all of these terms weren't bad enough, the worst was that the Spartans installed a pro-Spartan oligarchy in the city. Now, this oligarchy, called the Rule of the 30, was led by the extremist Critias, a relative of Plato and a student of Socrates. He'd been exiled when the rule of the 400 came to an end in 411. Critias had been one of their number. Well, now he was back, and he intended to make up for his previous treatment. The Athenian constitution tells us that these oligarchs wanted to stamp out blackmailers and sycophants, who they considered corrupt. But then they changed. These oligarchs abolished the courts and the boule. They protected themselves with an armed bodyguard called the whip bearers. So the name speaks for itself, doesn't it? And they even asked for 700 additional troops from Lysander to help them rule. Now, the 30 came to exercise power in a far more bloody way than the oligarchy of 411. Their regime was characterized by the exiling and murdering of opponents, citizens, and metics for personal reasons. According to the Athenian constitution, some 1,500 citizens were put to death, including Cleophon. Thousands of Athenians, Democrats that is, fled into exile, obviously terrified. Well, the rule of the 30 lasted from September of 404 to January of 403. And at that time, an Athenian named Thrasybulus and a group of exiled Democrats returned to Athens and brought the 30 to battle. They defeated them, and Critias himself, one of the tyrants, was killed in this battle. Athens was still not free from the tyranny, though, because the remaining tyrants expected Lysander to march into Attica and support them. But that wasn't to be. Lysander had now come to be viewed very suspiciously by the Spartan government. The Spartans might even have been taking into account the attitude of allies like Thebes and Megara, because these two places were appalled by the atrocities being committed by the 30, and they actually offered refuge to any Athenian exiles even though Thebes and Megara had been enemies of Athens and they were allies of Sparta. So in the end, the Spartan king Pausanias marched to Athens, and there he brokered a deal between the people, those that had stayed in Athens to support the 30 and the exiled Democrats. And this deal was that both sides agreed to reconcile their differences. Only the remnants of the actual 30 and their senior aides were to be put on trial. So by September 403, Thrasybulus and the Democrats were back in Athens, and the move to restore Athenian democracy had begun. So the tail end then of the Peloponnesian War and its aftermath were an inglorious period in Athenian history. And the entire war was a sad and inglorious period in Greek history, given the thousands of men that died in it, the massive blow it dealt to the economies of so many states, and the devastation to farms all over the place, regardless of what they grew. Thucydides was right to see this war as like no other. He wrote about it as a warning of the dangers of imperialism and the downsides of direct democracy, so that future generations might never make the same mistake again. To no avail. Given the resources of Athens compared to Sparta at the start of the Peloponnesian War in 431, all bets would have to have been on Athens as the city that would win. Yet Athens lost. How and why Athens lost, and what happened in Greek history after the Peloponnesian War, are the subjects of our next lecture. Thank you very much.